Hello and welcome to Tree Speech, a podcast where we get to know one another and the world, one tree at a time. I'm your host, Dori Robinson. I'm incredibly excited to introduce today's guest and our topic, the banyan tree. The banyan is the focal point of our story today as we speak with our guest, British playwright Gularana Mir. Gularana is an award-winning writer, applied theater practitioner, and one half of the Thelmas, a female London-based theater company devoted to empowering women to redress the equality imbalance in the arts. The Thelmas look for authentic and bittersweet stories that stay with you. They crave socially impactful narratives that reflect our society, but don't look to solve the prevalent issues. In addition to her playwriting, Gularana is a facilitator, delivering a range of workshops in community settings using theater, storytelling, and movement. She regularly writes for community and youth groups, and she is on the BBC's Northern Voices Development Program. Just a few writing credits include All the Small Things, a BBC children's short, and Coconut, which was nominated for 2 Off West End Theatre Awards, including Most Promising New Playwright. Gularana, along with Afshan D'Souza Lodi, is the co-writer of Santi and Naz, the play we will focus on during today's episode. Spanning between 1945 and 1949, the play is set against the backdrop of the Indian-Pakistan partition of 1947. A bit of information about this historic event. When the British Crown dissolved their rule over India, they partitioned it before leaving. This involved the hasty division of 2 provinces, Bengal and Punjab, based on district-wide non-Muslim or Muslim majorities. The new country lines were carelessly made by a British lawyer who had never before been to India and was given 36 days for the task, displacing between 10 to 20 million people along religious lines and creating an overwhelming refugee crisis, which included large-scale violence. Lives were uprooted and lost. The enormous rift has still not healed. Within this historic background, the play focuses on 2 young women, one Sikh, one Muslim, and the friendship they fight for. Santi and Naz won an original award for outstanding new work and was a finalist for Best Stage Production at Asian Media Awards. One review stated, "This is a play that is intimately aware that there are stories everywhere and that the more subtle ones can resonate more strongly if we are willing to seek them out and listen to them amongst the brash cacophony of competing voices." Santi and Naz is a gently powerful play that continues to drift across the borders of our mind long after the lights go down and we are once more partitioned into performers and audience. So much of Gularana's work faces uncomfortable conflicts about race, religion, power dynamics, and gender in a way that is completely authentic to her. Her plays have wit, a sense of excitement, and most of all, bravery. Speaking with her always leaves me inspired. Gularana fully believes that our stories are powerful and worth sharing right now without delay. We will begin by taking one deep breath all together to feel as grounded as the trees we discuss. And take a nice big breath in and out. I am here with Gularana Mir, and she is a phenomenal playwright, educator, theater maker, and human who I had the great fortune of meeting many years ago at NYU, and I'm so happy to have you here with us today. Hi, Gularana.
Hi, Dori. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm all right. That was a lovely introduction.
Oh, well. Thank you. Yeah, with pleasure. I mean, I think we met one of my first days at NYU, the second day at NYU I met you. So, you know, we go back a long way in terms of our artistic educational careers and in terms of our lives.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I can't remember my first few days at NYU with the trauma of trying to find somewhere to live and going to classes. It just all smushes into one, but it's definitely been a long time and a great pleasure.
So, Gularana, can you please tell us a story about a tree?
So, I grew up in suburban London, trees are just things to me. And the tree that I have brought to this space today doesn't come from my life directly. It comes from the world of a play that I've written, and it is a banyan tree, often referred to in Hindi as a bor. And in the play, this banyan tree is very significant for the two characters, Santi and Naz, who are two young women living in a small village in Punjab in India in the time approaching the partition. And for those of you that don't know, India was this massive country, and when the British left and gave India its independence, it was split into East Pakistan, India, and West Pakistan, East Pakistan now being Bangladesh. But the Punjab region that the two girls live in was split between, so it was split into two and became Pakistan and India. But this tree is significant to these two young girls because it sits on the edge of a lake. And as most young people do in countries that are warm, they tend to spend a lot of time at the lake. And so this tree is their tree. It's basically where they've spent all of their childhood splashing, climbing, hiding. And over the course of the play becomes more and more important to them to have a place that they can go to be safe together. And then, without any spoilers, the play also happens to be a site of a significant act of violence. And it just sort of became, which I don't want to say a framing device, but it just became a location that was so inherently part of the story that, for me, the tree's a character almost in itself. And whilst that's not really there in the script, it's there in the language of the play, and it was sort of for the actors, I think, and when they read the script and brought it to life, we all realised collectively in that rehearsal room how important that tree is. So, yes, it's a tree I bring to you.
This is a different kind of tree than past guests have offered. Would you describe the banyan tree?
Banyan trees are like they're incredibly large. They have these massive trunks and roots that, you know, grow to sizes where you could conceivably hide within them. And then their leaves droop over and quite often create sort of like canopies. So they really are, or could be, places of refuge. And they remind me a lot of willows, actually. I think they're the eastern version of willow trees.
So I have many questions about this play and how this play came about, but let's start with the tree itself, because you said yourself that you are, I mean, you are self-described as an urbanite, and yet you write a play where the tree is sort of the focal location. How did you decide that? How did that come to be?
I think that comes from the fact that this story is very much a rural story. It's a rural village. And although I myself grew up in suburban London, I spent a lot of summers going back to Pakistan during my childhood. And even then, you know, we lived in suburban Islamabad. Well, my grandparents lived in a small town city called Rawalpindi. It's where the international airport is. It's about an hour outside of Islamabad, the capital. And again, it wasn't particularly rural, but was expansive in terms of nature. And I recall my childhood in Pakistan being much more about nature than home in London was. I gave you that tree, and then thinking about it, there are other trees. There was a tree outside of my cousin's, so people live in extended families. So my cousin lived with their family, and several of us lived abroad. So in the summers, there'd be young people from England, young people from the States, as well as the young people that were still living in Pakistan. And there was this tree that grew, and the upper branches reached, I think, the second floor of the family home. So there was always somebody that would try and climb out the window and down the tree, and we would try and climb up the tree into the window. All sorts of shenanigans that were tree related. So for me, when we were creating the characters of Santi and Naz, and we were thinking about what it means to be a child in that region, in that part of the world, actually the joy of like being able to run free and climb trees and be in nature was really important. Going back to my grandparents' house was, you know, reasonably large. People have big gardens. They're generally walled, so they're quite safe. And they might have multiple trees in them. Some people have even had sort of orchards on their properties. In rural villages, you don't have so many expansive gardens, but what you have is just expansive countryside and nature. So I took that element of visiting the motherland and sort of thought about, well, okay, these girls that have grown up in this area, they will have done the same things, but more, and pushed that further. You know, I think we all know, we all have an idea of what young girls are allowed to do and what they're not allowed to do. But actually, in rural areas, you have so much more freedom because there's such less things that can go wrong. Everybody knows everybody in their village. There is no chance of, well, I say no chance, there's very little chance of like being abducted. You have, it's that case of Simba, everything that you see before you is yours. So the girls have the same, in the play, have that same idea that everything that they can see from their huts is theirs, and it's theirs to play with. So this lake is theirs, this tree is theirs, and that's their dominion. And that's the joy of a play until somebody comes along and tells them that it's not theirs anymore.
Did you ever try to climb that tree to the second floor?
I have a pretty strong memory of trying to climb a tree. I don't think I managed it though. And also, we weren't allowed to do anything that might result in broken bones, because nobody wants to go to hospital in a foreign country, do they?
No, nobody does. It's so interesting because many of your other plays are set in modern day. They have to do with relationships with one another, person to person. This is one of the first times I've heard you sort of tackle a piece where it is not just person to person, but person with nation, or person with politics, or person with, you know, outside forces. First of all, that's wonderful. And I'm excited about it. How did you go on that trajectory?
So I think that even though Santi Naz is about a big moment in history, a big moment in politics, it's about the partition. Actually, it's not. It's a play about two young girls who are best of friends. And it's about those intense childhood friendships where, you know, feelings are feelings and we don't know what those mean. And it's about that really grey, muddy time in your life where you think you might love your best friend, but you don't know what that means. It was described really beautifully by a critic in London as a queer love story. And I think we were very cautious to give it that label, but essentially that's what it is. And I really wanted to do something to commemorate the 70th anniversary of the partition of India. I felt it was really important that we talked about it more in Britain, because it's just not on our history curriculums. We don't talk about colonialism or empire. And then thirdly, there had been the reversion of the Anti-Homosexuality Act that actually Britain was responsible for in India. So that was a colonial law that had finally been overturned. And so we put everything together, and that's how it started. And it had been a really collaborative process of creation. But it was, you're right, Dory, I had never written anything historical before. It had always been about modern relationships. But what we had decided from the offset was that this was not going to be a history play. It was a play that was about two young girls that we felt that we wanted anyone to recognize. We do want to revise it and, you know, flesh out that part of the world for probably next year, 2022, which will be the 75th anniversary, and also the 50th anniversary of the Commonwealth. So we're planning a national tour of the show, and that will probably bring in some more of the political elements.
Well, first, good luck with the national tour. That is no small endeavor, and yet I know that the Thelmas are undoubtedly ready. Second, I truly appreciate that approach, Gularana, that it's not about writing a history play, and that history is personal. It's not about a timeline on a page, but rather how those events impacted real people.
You learn about everything that's happening in the outside world through the eyes of these two young girls, right? So there's a scene where they're playing politics. One of them is pretending to be Gandhi, and the other one is pretending to be Muhammad Ali Jinnah, so the guy that founded Pakistan. I also think it's really important to note that whilst I was doing the research for the play, I discovered things about these men that are just really abhorrent. right? And these are great political leaders. I mean, Gandhi is revered world around. And just when you learn about what these men did and what they stand for, and like, it just became even more important to us that we did not give these men the platform. And I think what was really interesting for us as well was like with Brexit, and there was just such a feeling of sort of, as women in 2020, we still have no agency. We still have no voice in, like, no one's listening to what we want. So it felt really pertinent to make sure that these two basically kids in rural India got the chance to tell their story.
Absolutely. It's a struggle to hear individual and worthy voices through the discord. So you were considering all these very large issues, including Brexit. Do you remember when you sort of came up with the specific concept for Santi and Naz? How did you bring together these thoughts into the seed of this play?
I was writer in residence at SOAS University, so the School of Oriental and African Studies, not that that's what it goes by. It was essentially a school that was created to train colonial officers before they went out to the countries that they were going to be stationed in. And the project that I was part of was called Decolonizing History, and it was a real sort of attempt to rewrite or balance the books for what SOAS had been complicit in. And SOAS now is the only institution in Europe that teaches history from a non-Western perspective. And five writers were brought in to spend a whole semester at SOAS, and we were given staff passes and free rein to be like, let's take some classes, let's talk to students, let's talk to teachers, let's try to ascertain what decolonizing history looks like in practice. Is it just a buzzword? What does that mean for the brown, black students? What does that mean for white students? Like, what's going on? And then we got to write 20-minute audio dramas in response to them. What my takeaway was that all history is subjective. Whoever wrote it came with an agenda. Whoever won gets to tell their story. That was really a change of mindset for me, that actually history is now personal history. I don't care what's written in the textbooks. What's important to me is the people that lived it. Like, I think for me, it sort of is a history play because that's the kind of history that's really important to me. But from everyone else's standards, no, it's not a history play. Like, it's not Henry V, right?
Nor should it be, because that, as you've mentioned, that is the history we learn. We learn about it from the male perspective. We learn about it from a white perspective. We don't learn about it from different perspectives. And that's what makes this so interesting, because we always think about learning history in a certain way. It's dates, it's facts, it's specific wars and who won them. So I want to ask you about that, because I know from my heritage, there is a deep responsibility to carry the stories of others who have come before. And it seems that that is perhaps similar for you, or rather I should ask, does that resonate with you? And how does that resonate with the Thelmas? So the Thelmas, your theater company, seems to give voice to the voiceless, or seems to bring up topics that aren't often spoken about?
Well, let me answer that second part of that question first. That was a large question. The second part is yes, absolutely. So the Thelmas, I think if we had two main objectives, the first is to be subversive and irreverent, right? So no stereotypes. In fact, let's blast the stereotypes out of the water, and any sort of issues that come up in the play must be tackled with a lens of, it's not about the issues, it's about the people, it's about the characters and their personal stories. And then the second part of that is that we are all complex human beings, and that should be reflected in the storytelling. So this notion of intersectionality is really, really important. The first half of your question about, do I feel a sense of responsibility? I mean, yeah, but I think it comes in part from understanding that people like my parents, people like my grandparents have experienced great things. I feel like I have a greater responsibility to British Asians than I do to my grandparents necessarily. I feel that representation in stage and screen in the UK is really important. So for me, I want to write a lot of stuff that draws on that history, but actually it's much more important to me that young women who look like me, who might have had some similar experiences to me, who are essentially British, get to see themselves as part of the mainstream media. Both Maddie and I are committed to doing the audience development work to make sure that the right people see the work, but also people who have no idea and who sit outside of the communities come and see it and are, if not educated, at least, like, because nobody wants to educate. What a horrible thing. You know, I want my work to educate. How patronizing. What you want is to be moved or to be surprised. Roy Williams, the British playwright, black man, says he goes to the theatre for three things. He wants to be surprised, educated, and entertained, right? Which I think is a great mantra to take forward. And I'd like to idealistically think that we do that at the Thelmas.
So you went through, was it SOAS, the fellowship?
Yes, SOAS.
So after SOAS, you have all this new information and the Thelmas have put out this script and are going to do it again, which is wonderful. Where do you go from here? Where would, in a dream world, where would Gularan Amir want to go?
My trajectory, you're asking, is I want to show at the National and I want to transfer to the West End.
That is phenomenal. I want that too. Again, I think that it's very interesting that you as a playwright are able to give voice to the people who face these disconnections. From two girls who grow up being able to play anywhere to no longer having that freedom, all the way to wanting plays by brown and black women to be at the National. So now let me ask you, you mentioned being a fledgling playwright. What would be your advice to a young female British playwright?
Okay, so not to myself, because I think the question often comes like, you know, what advice would you give in your younger self? I think to other fledgling playwrights. So I teach a lot, and the thing that I always teach when I run masterclasses is like, what is the most crazy way you could tell your story? How to make this not boring? I mentor university students, right? I mentor at the Central School of Speech and Drama, and I go and I read idea after idea, and my first question when I do my tutorials is like, why is this a play? So that would always be my advice. How do you take what you've got and elevate it? How do you give voice to those, or how do you bring a perspective to the stage that I've never seen or heard or read before? What makes this play interesting and different and exciting? Find that. And then you're on a home stretch of greatness.
I'd love to be on a home stretch of greatness. And that is exactly what I wish to you, what I wish to the Thelmas, and what I wish to all of your students, a home stretch of greatness. Gularan, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today. I'm just so grateful to speak with you. From one banyan tree, we have come all the way to identity politics and education and so much. Thank you for these rich, rich stories and ideas.
Yeah, I'll just add that I think with everything that we've talked about, it's really easy to get into this mindset that the only stories worth telling are the great, powerful ones about, you know, big issues and make big, bold statements. And whilst personally, that's my politic, like I want to write plays that speak to things that are happening in the world. I don't think they all have to be dark and about oppression or have to be, you don't have to serve your trauma up on a plate. I think that's a really important thing to say. And there's such beautiful moments of joy. Like I know I wrote Santi and Naz, but I just love that play. Like I don't know where it came from. I still read it sometimes and I'm like, did we write this? It's so good. It's so joyous. It's so beautiful. Like, and I think everything should have at least a moment or a symbol of hope, because otherwise all we're doing is regurgitating everything that's terrible about society. And putting that for people to see and not offering any light or hope or any opportunity for change, right?
I love that. I think that you said a moment of hope, that every story or every play should have a moment of hope. And I concur. So here's to hope and joy in the stories we tell. So to close, we're going to take another deep breath in and out, breathing in. And breathing out. Thank you so much, Gularana.
Thanks so much for having me.
And now for today's tree takeaways. Banyans are incredibly sacred trees and are worshipped in many parts of India, Malaysia, and Thailand. Buddha is supposed to have sat under the banyan tree for 7 days after he was enlightened. Hindus say that Krishna, the god of compassion, tenderness, and love, stood beneath a banyan tree when he delivered the sermon of the Bhagavad Gita. As the banyan tree grows, it develops aerial roots from the horizontal branches that grow down towards the ground. These roots grow into stout, branch-supporting pillars that penetrate deep into the soil. In this way, the tree appears immortal. There's no apparent beginning or end to them. The banyan has the largest canopy cover of any tree. There is one in India which covers 4.7 acres and can shelter 20,000 people. That is why Indian traders, or banyas, use their shade to conduct meetings or business deals, giving the tree its name. Gularana mentioned that banyans can be used for protection and refuge. According to Greek historians, Alexander the Great and his army of 7,000 people took refuge under a single banyan tree in 326 BCE. The tree as a place of refuge is such a potent image to me. Refuge comes in many forms. For Santi and Naz, the banyan is like a secret hideout where they can truly be themselves and speak fully their independent minds. The banyan can also be a peaceful haven, a multi-columned sanctuary, all stemming from a single trunk. One doesn't simply sit under the tree, but within it. It invites privacy, introspection, a chance for us to look within ourselves and find whatever truth is there. Something else that sticks with me are the banyan's aerial roots. As they spread further and further away from the original trunk, it looks as though they are taking steps and walking away, which gives the tree the moniker, the walking tree, or the one with many feet. It's as though the tree wants to remind us that we continue to move and grow, but are always connected to our original roots. There is always a link back to our origins. What do you think, tree lovers? Do you have a place that you feel connected to, no matter where you go? In our previous episode with Nave Cohen, one of the many things we explored was the duality of the oak tree. It is both strong and mighty, but also soft and protective. This week, Gularana's tree is the epicenter for division. The deep wound of the 1947 partition continues to impact the region significantly. Over the course of centuries, the banyan became a symbol of life and resurrection. However, it became a symbol of death when the British used them as gallows to execute resistant rebels. When India gained independence, it restored the banyan's dignity by making it the national tree. The stories about banyan trees and those who live by them are incredibly powerful and heart-wrenching. Yet Gularana gracefully balances these important topics with an innate humor and sweetness. She deftly turns our heads away from the men in charge of governments or wars to look deeper through the historic moments to the people whose voices and personal stories are rarely heard. A true educator, Gularana leaves us with two challenges. First, to tell our stories and express ourselves in a way that is authentic and honest, remembering the levity and joy that life provides even in troubled times. And second, not being afraid to go beyond the stereotype or status quo to understand history and people through the personal over what history has dictated, to remember the intersectionality of circumstances with openness. Today is Arbor Day, first celebrated in Nebraska in 1872 with the planting of 1 million trees. Arbor Day is now celebrated in all 50 states and around the world, with trees planted as a symbol of hope, reflecting that same hope that Gularana's work proves so vital in our lives. As the Arbor Day organization so eloquently states, while most holidays celebrate something that has already happened and is worth remembering, Arbor Day represents a hope for the future. The simple act of planting a tree represents a belief that the tree will grow to provide us with clean air and water, cooling shade, habitat for wildlife, healthier communities, and endless natural beauty. All for a better tomorrow. This week's episode was recorded in Massachusetts on the native lands of the Wabanaki Confederacy, Penacook, Massachusetts, and Pawtucket people. Logo designed by Mill Riot. Tree Speech is produced by Jonathan Zoutner and a Light Theater Guild. The mission of the Guild is to advance compelling theatrical endeavors that showcase the diversity of our ever-changing world in order to build strong artists whose work creates empathy, challenges the status quo, and unites communities. In addition to Tree Speech, a Light Theater Guild has other wonderful programs, including NYC Queer Playback Theater. For more information about our work and programs, please visit alighttheater.org. Please join Tree Speech for the rest of the spring season as we continue to hear more about various trees from various voices. Most of all, learn about Tree Speech at treespeechpodcast.com and on Instagram with the handle Tree Speech Podcast. Thanks for joining Tree Speech today.